Okay.
So with only the boats of Black and Douglas, of course I was too short, and my famous Anglo-Saxon day in court was terminated and due process was aborted, and I think the case is still moot because it's never been fully adjudicated.
Were you blacklisted after your firing? Were you able to get jobs other places? Or
very thoroughly. Everybody was scared of McCarthy, and I don't know how many applications I got out, but I never got a smell of a job until I was in private practice both here and in Hollywood a bit, but I never made any more than I usually made on the side as a psychologist, but officing with MDs as a rule, I preferred to practice scrupulously. But I didn't get anything until in Europe in 1960, the AAUP wrote that the climate had so changed in this country that they'd set up a retired professor's registry, and if I wished to register, they thought they could find something for me. So my very domestic wife, who'd become an international bum, said, "What's all this mail you're getting?" And we realized that if we came back, I'd have to go to work again. So, in fact, we were seeing Europe on $400 a month and saving $100 to get back on. You could do it in those days. I had students all over the place, though, and I got some free rent, I admit. But then I got five offers through the AUP and chose to pinch hit for a year in Michigan, and then went to the Atlanta University System, Morehouse College particularly, Martin Luther King School, and was there for 4 years. And we were very close to the Kings, three generations of them. And in the whole kneel-in, die-in, cry-in period, we were the only whites in the area of several blocks near the university and college.
After you were fired, I recall reading the one article that you written there, that apparently you did a little tour, you went on to Europe and just traveling.
In 1958, our son came home for Christmas with one-way tickets to Europe. So he said, "You've never been there, you've talked a lot about it, and you've got nothing better to do." So we married our daughter off in the spring of 1959. We'd already sent her over there to reconnoiter for us, so to speak. She attended the University of Vienna for a semester in the fall of 1958. So we went over 5 minutes before April in 59, save summer rates, and got lost in Europe for 17 months in 17 countries.
Mm-hmm. You may have already answered this question, but I might rephrase it again. Were you ever able to find equal employment of the type you had before? Did you have to just take part-time things and pieces?
Well, yes and no. In positions, yes, but not in income. That is, of course, the black colleges were not paying so well as California by far, but Canada came pretty close to it, and there I was visiting professor of psychology at the University of Alberta and also director of psychology at the Royal Alexandra Hospital, and the last year counselor at the university, but those salaries were $12,000-$14,000 plus maybe a few dollars on the side, but California was better.
Yeah. What about do you ever notice, was the political climate in Canada anything like it was here, or was it much more relaxed? Or were they uptight about communism too?
No, the political climate in Canada was more mature and tolerant, and for example, at the university, I helped organize a seminar of the faculty on permanence and change in Eastern Europe. And we varied in our views from left to right, but we all tried to be scholars, and we educated each other, and we would not debate. We would present a thesis, and when we ran out of facts, we'd stop. But we would be questioned about our facts and not our views. And we also formed the Academic Society for Academic Intercultural Exchanges. It worked to some extent. And the climate was quite good. We liked Canada so well, we wanted to retire there. There's another story about that that's not complete. I'd rather not get into it right now.
Okay. Why do you think the political climate in the United States was so severe? Was it the Cold War? Was it the multiplicity of things? Or was it any one particular thing you could put your finger on?
Well, it was the Cold War. I don't believe in sharp demarcations in the history of a large country. I think from 1917, the competition between capitalism and communism or socialism has not yet become a fully civilized competition. But I'm hoping that it may become. I hope we'll never get over competition in ideas. But to call ideas subversive and attack people for ideas is barbarous.
I've read quite a bit about the blacklisting period in American history, particularly in Hollywood in that region. But it still seems to be kind of amazing. I've heard different writers claim it was mass hysteria. To see how people could get so hysterical and upset about the fear of practicing other politics. For example, I've heard people say that anyone who talks of politics outside the Democratic Republican Party is subversive, which is kind of humorous. But what do you attribute this to?
Well, yes, people pursue their own advantages in their ideological formulations. The ideological composition of the individual is a very interesting subject. You're right. My attorney before the House Un-American Activities Committee in the spring of 1953 was Bob Kenney, who had been Attorney General of California, and a very dear friend. And he had defended the Hollywood Ten and learned that the Bill of Rights had been suspended. So when the ACLU pivoted my case on test of the First Amendment, he said, "Harry, you're a dead duck." And he bowed out because he'd already got burned on that one. Really, you ought to ask me about that case. The ACLU I had belonged to, we'd belonged to for 20 years before, and I had a notion that I was entitled to some consideration. But when the ACLU dictated the strategy of my defense and I went to them for consultation, the very first thing their attorney did was to rub his hands and said, "How much money do you have?" And I'm sorry to say this because I regard him fairly well. But it was a futile thing. I wish that he had put my case on not only the First Amendment, but the property rights too, because at the just before the court, a young aircraft attorney, registered Republican, a former student, called up and said, "I'd like to file an amicus curiae brief in your behalf." I said, "For heaven's sake, why? How so?" Well, he said, "We do a little business with the state, and if in the middle of an ongoing contract, without proof that the other party is reneged in any way, a new condition cannot be stipulated. And they're trying to hang you on that." So with great glee, I told the ACLU attorney about that one, getting an amicus curiae brief from the attorney of an aircraft company. And he said, "Nothing doing." So my property rights, my tenure, were not emphasized, but by implication, at least according to Jesse Carter in his dissent, they were more than implicated. And that was violated, and the tenure law was broken by my suspension. I think that's the term in the law, which became a permanent, after it carried on. Well,
basically, as a teacher, then you were operating under a contract.
Of course.
Right, and as long as you fulfilled your end of the bargain, the contract, that's what you're saying, then, basically.
Exactly.
Okay. It's a very important point.
Exactly, a very important point. And that's quite a bit the basis of my claim against the state now. And I think that the state owes me, they owe itself to redeem its honor in the matter of compensating me for the 6 years of total unemployment and the 8 years of employment at less than the California scale and a miserable retirement monthly check of $495.95 a month now, even with the cost of living increments.
Well, there was, if I recall reading the papers, there was a bill which was before the state legislature just prior to the vote on Proposition 13. Is that correct? And that Proposition 13 was passed, and then they axed that bill? I think that was correct. I'm not sure.
Oh, you must be referring to Assembly Bill 3026, which some friendly assemblyman got in to compensate all those
right.
McCarthy victims,
right.
Principally the levering oath folks. But I contend that the Luckel Act, which the only question I was asked under the Luckel Act was really the levering question. And levering permits the individualization of the Luckel permits the individualization of the levering.
Mm-hmm.
And this proposition that the friendly assemblyman sponsored would have given us, me in my case, a tithe or $25,000, all of us equally, regardless of the fact that our separate claims ran from $40,000 to $500,000, $25,000 each. And this was finally compromised between the two houses, and I believe it was attached to a $7 million bill for compensating already affluent doctors who claimed to have given services to welfare patients that had not been authorized services. And after we had been expunged, the legislature passed the $7 million, gave it to the doctors, and we didn't get a cent. Some people seem to think that we've had something from the state. We haven't had a nickel.
Okay, how did the years from 1954 to the present really affect your life? Obviously, you lost your job, and I'm sure it was...
Well, yeah, it affected my life in various ways. In some ways, my wife took a nice humorous attitude. It was the best thing that ever happened to me because we got all over Europe, been there six times now, oh, seven times, and around the world, and... broadened our understanding of a lot of humanities and social studies, but it devastated me professionally, of course, completely. I think that I was engaged in some very promising research, and I think I said as in the San Diego Tribune that actually the punitive measures that I suffered from were a little bit tardy because I had an unnecessary. I was already inclining toward the pursuit of my doctoral interests.
Mm-hmm. Okay, looking back at your career and the problems you had at state, and what would you have done differently if you could go back and change some particular point in your life that might have made a difference?
Well, I don't know, you know. Life has its inexorable aspects, and you go on living from day to day without, at least I don't consume myself in regrets. I wish that I had dropped the ACLU and taken Bob Kenny and let him stipulate my tenure and fight it out on that basis, and I think I might then have remained employed. But I would not have reneged on the principle of the thing at any point, because I think I'm right.
Who were the attorneys for ACLU that were defending you in that particular instance?
Well, Al Wieran.
Al Wieran? Mm-hmm.
Mainly. I kind of thought Pat Brown, who was Attorney General, tried to lose the case, but he couldn't do it in those days. McCarthy requirements were so rigid. The law is so rigid, he had to go with the law and the books of the state. But I've never held any animosity for participants in those legal things.
Mm-hmm. A.L. Wren, of course, had some experiences back in the 1930s down in the Imperial Valley I'd read about.
Oh, yes, I knew those very well, and quite a number of people were wrapped up. In fact, I was told to stay out of the Imperial Valley or I'd never get out. So I didn't get over there and become a hero of those days, but in the background I was helping quite a bit. In fact, I don't mind admitting that, there are aspects of that I prefer to keep from my autobiography.
The thing that interests me is that it seems that Imperial Valley hasn't grown and it hasn't matured politically since that period because of Metzger now. It seems to have gained a great deal of votes in the 43rd Congressional District, which is kind of interesting.
Well, yes, there's a lot of that hoi polloi stupidity prevalent, and some baronial landed interests feudal in their aspect. But on the other hand, the only other luckle victim that I know of is my dear friend Carl Callender, who is a tree surgeon, and he was caught subverting the trees in the bushes. So he was fired by the Board of Supervisors, or their whoever was in the Park Commission at that time, and his case was subordinated to mine, and when I didn't get anywhere, his case was not pursued further, but he certainly is entitled, as I am, to recompense for grave injury and injustice. And he lives in the Imperial Valley, and I think the people over there have been pretty tolerant. He seems to have friends in several directions. They're rather surprising and gratifying. So I don't think they're all uncivilized over there.
No, I'm sure they're not. I didn't really mean to imply
that. Yeah, but I wanted
that.
To get that in.
Right. I think you may have answered this question already, but let's maybe just pursue it one more time. Would you have testified any differently in any of your hearings that you had? And I look at the HUAC as kind of an abomination.
Yeah.
And I can understand why you would take a stand against them, because they seem to be almost pernicious as far as I'm concerned.
Oh, I was before the House Un-American Activities Committee in the spring of 55 and here in San Diego in the summer, 53 and the summer of 1955 here. But that had nothing legal to do with my elimination from state employment. I got by with defying them, and I would defy them again even more forcefully than I did if I had it to do over again. And I see no reason to water down my principles.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you were before the HUAC, how did they conduct it? I mean, was it, I've heard some testimony, I've read some testimony, but was it kind of a badgering, hard-nosed attitude towards questioning?
Yes, there was a bulldog tenacity with the main point that they were pursuing without regard to your response. I was before Veldy and Walters. See, Congressman Jackson was in there too. I can't remember the other congressmen's names. But it was, it was pretty trying because it was tricky. And in those days, if you conceded anything in your own behalf, you would be subjecting yourself to interrogation regarding others, and that was the principal reason that I defied them, because if I had submitted, obviously I knew a lot of communists, and I could be asked about them, and I wasn't about to submit to that.
Well, Veldy had a reputation for being kind of a tough individual. I've forgotten now, but I've read some testimony where...
Yeah, former FBI agent.
Yeah. I read some testimony where he had been interrogating a black individual. I can't remember who it was, but I think he was with the railway union or something, and he cursed him out and everything else right there in the testimony. It was kind of interesting. Apparently, he was very, very abusive.
Yes, you had no political, you had no legal recourse to what they called you, I guess. But I don't remember Valdi, if indeed he actually sat. It may have been that Walters sat in his place as chairman when I was before him. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you have any concluding statements you might want to make about the firing or anything about it, or do you think that you pretty much summed it up?
Well, I pretty well summed it up, except that I don't see how anybody can consider the facts of the case without agreeing that I have a strong claim for recompense for the injury done me by the state. And it's a state I still love, and I would like to see its honor redeemed.
Do you think that you're going to be able to win over a decision of some sort?
Well, the issue now, I suppose, I'm represented by the California Congress of Faculty Associations, and I hope the California State Employees Association, and I should think any of the other faculty associations would be in favor of my case or claim. But what's your question?
Well, I was thinking that you think that you're going to have a reasonable
chance. Well, yes, I started to say the issue is whether we should go before the legislature with a special bill or whether we should go to court again. The court is menacing because of the long, drawn-out procedures required. The state is questionable on account of the political composition of the voters. And I think that in the last vote that I mentioned a little while ago, it came out 42 in our favor, 26 against, and what was it, a dozen abstentions or something, 13 abstentions. So you see, the change of a very few votes would have given us at least a pittance, 25,000. But a small vote. The main thing, I think, is the impediment of the Luckel Act. If the state employees and the legislature would rescind the Luckel Act, then I think Carl Callender and I would have a clear case, and it would be settled perhaps even out of court.
Okay, thanks very much. Mm-hmm. Dr. Steinmetz, maybe one last question. What is your attitude towards San Diego State University today?
Well, I think it's in the record. I have been loyal to the university from the beginning. I was vice president of the University of California's program for the retired called Institute for Continued Learning until I had a little heart trouble. And then San Diego State started this. And I became chairman of the board there for a couple of years until I had another little heart problem, but I have helped develop that program, and that's my institution. That's the institution I'm loyal to. I would like to feel the faculty was a little bit more up to date and the times with regard to issues of justice and their own academic interests. I am a little disappointed in the almost indifference of the AAUP throughout, and I'm entertained by the fact that it seems to be slipping nationally. But I'm proud of San Diego State and its development, and I hope that I can assist in any little way in the years ahead, as I think I'm doing perhaps a little bit now, in the development of its relations of theory to practice.